You've got a rather busy week ahead of you, haven't you?
Yeah, I've got two lectures on Tuesday. One is a chemistry lecture at 10 a.m. and the other is microbiology at 2 o'clock. The microbiology lecture goes for 1 hour and then it's followed immediately by a lab.
What lab is that?
Plant pathology.
That sounds like quite a full day.
Well, actually Wednesday is my busiest. I've got two tutorials, a lecture and a chemistry lab. The lab's first thing in the morning at 9 o'clock. That goes until 11 o'clock. Then my first tutorial, that's plant pathology, is at 12. I get a couple of hours break for lunch and relaxation. Then at 3 o'clock, I've got another tutorial, my microbiology tutorial. That goes for 2 hours. Finally, at 5 o'clock, I've got my genetics lecture.
Phew, I see what you mean about Wednesday being your busiest day. What about the rest of the week?
Well, I've got nothing on Thursday, thankfully. And Friday's a short day. I've just got a lecture, plant pathology. And the best thing is that it begins at 10 o'clock in the morning. So from 11 o'clock, I'm free to enjoy the weekend.
That is the end of section one. You now have half a minute to check your answers. Listening section 2. In a moment, you are going to hear a talk given by Ms. Margaret Sales, a travel writer. She will be talking about travel to the Pacific Island country of Astoria. Before you listen, look at questions 12 to 15. An example has been provided for you. As you listen to the first part of the talk, answer questions 12 to 15.
Good morning, everyone. My name's Margaret Sales. I'm a journalist who specializes in travel. Some of you may read the travel section of the newspaper, so you know the kinds of articles I write. Anyway, I'm not here to tell you about my job. I've been invited here by the Astoria Tourism Bureau to tell you about travel to Astoria. Now, as I'm sure most of you know, Astoria is a rather large island, located 1,100 kilometres from New Zealand. That's 1,100 kilometres in a northeast direction, I should say. As you can see on this map here, it's about 25% larger than New Zealand. And it has quite a different shape. While New Zealand's long and thin, Astoria has the shape of a rectangle. Some people would say almost square. Now, I guess none of you here has been to Astoria yet, so let me give you a bit of a description. Most of the people there live in the northern half of the island. This part of the island is warmer than the southern half. But it wouldn't be fair to say that the southern half is cold. In fact, the whole island is close enough to the equator so that no matter how far south you go, you wouldn't even need a jumper to stay warm.
Now look at questions 16 to 23. Note the examples that have been done for you. As the talk continues, answer questions 16 to 23.
There are four provinces in Astoria. Each has its own unique features and, in fact, One of them speaks a different language. The northwest quarter of the country is the province of Hornchurch. The capital of the country, which is called New Birmingham, is located in Hornchurch, and that's where the first English settlers came in the year 1756. New Birmingham is Astoria's largest city and the centre of its industry. And it's the culture of this part of the island that attracts so many tourists to Hornchurch. The culture's a strange mix of Old English and Polynesian. New Birmingham is where you'll most likely enter the country if you're going by air, because it has the busiest airport. Hornchurch's population is 2.5 million. The second largest province in terms of population is New Devon. It's got 500,000 people fewer than Hornchurch. New Devon takes up the northeast quarter of the country. Now, if you're the type of person who likes the beach, this is the best part of the island. The beaches are absolutely beautiful here, and they go on for miles. There are beach resorts all along the coast on this part of the island, and no matter how much money you want to spend on your holiday, there are beach resorts that will suit your budget in New Devon. South of New Devon is the province of Anglesark. This is the most mountainous part of Astoria, and it's least populated. Only 250,000 people live here. The mountains in Anglesark are well known for their hot springs, and many Astorians, as well as tourists, go there to rest and relax in the mineral baths. The hot springs are probably the best reason to visit the province, especially if you want to get away from the more crowded beaches of the northeastern part of the island. But take along a good pair of hiking boots if you want to take advantage of the wonderful bushwalking in the Anglesark Mountains. The fourth province of Astoria is in the southwest quarter of the island. It's called New Albion. Now that may sound deceptively English, but actually that's not the language you're likely to hear in New Albion. Although the English were the first Europeans to come to Astoria, explorers from Spain came only a few months later, and they settled in this part of the island. Today, Spanish is still the main language in New Albion, while people in the other three provinces communicate in English. Overseas visitors like to come to New Albion to indulge in one of Astoria's more famous agricultural products, wine. I'm sure you know that Astoria's wines are considered to be some of the best in the world. Well, all of the wine produced in Astoria is made in New Albion, because the weather here is perfect for it. Warm days and cool nights, but not too humid. By the way, New Albion has the only other international airport in Astoria, so it's possible to arrive there first if you're going by air. Okay, I've briefly told you about the place. Now let me show you some slides, and then I'll tell you about prices and travel arrangements and...
That is the end of section two. You now have 30 seconds to check your answers. Listening section 3. In a moment, you are going to hear an interview between Ms. Marilyn Stokes, a radio interviewer, and Mr. Roger Harridan, a scientist working in the field of sensory perception. Before you listen, look at questions 24 to 33. Note the example done for you. As you listen to the conversation, answer questions 24 to 33.
Our next guest is Mr. Roger Harradon. Roger is a scientist at the National Institute for Sense and Sensory Perception. He has come here to chat with us about our sense of smell. You know, how we use our nose. How are you today, Roger?
Very well, thank you, Marilyn.
You know, Roger, I love the smell of flowers and good food cooking, but I must admit, I've never really given much thought to my sense of smell.
Well, Marilyn, you're not alone in that. Most people would say their eyesight was their most important sense, but I suspect very few people would consider their nose or the idea of smell in that way.
Unless, of course, you make perfume for a living.
Yes, indeed. I'm sure most of your listeners would have heard of Immanuel Kant.
Immanuel Kant, the German philosopher, you mean?
That's right. Now, Kant, who lived 200 years ago, was the first person we know of to rank the five senses in order of importance. Kant put seeing, or eyesight, in the first position. He regarded it as absolutely the most important sense. Now, what do you think he chose for number two?
Oh, I really don't know. But if it were me, I'd choose hearing, I suppose.
Well, that's exactly what Kant chose as well. For the third most important sense, he chose touch. And touch was followed by taste.
Which leaves smell on the very bottom.
I'm afraid so. But this was simply the opinion of one man, of course. Actually, Kant was interested in the ideas of subjectivity and objectivity. He put smell last because he felt that it was subjective. He thought the senses of seeing and hearing and touch were objective, while taste and smell, he said, were subjective senses. He even went so far as to say that we humans don't need our sense of smell, that we can easily live without it. He obviously didn't have much use for these subjective senses.
Well, I can't say I agree with him on that last point. Roger, how well can people smell?
Well, most people have quite normal, quite acceptable abilities to smell. I mean, if there was a gas leak in this room, for example, the average person would notice fairly quickly. But some people are known as odour blind. Such people can't smell certain odours, certain smells. Just like people who are colourblind may not be able to see a particular colour. An odour-blind person may be able to enjoy the smell of one kind of flower, just as you or I would, but another kind of flower that you or I think smells wonderful, well, they wouldn't be able to smell a thing.
How extraordinary!
It is, isn't it? Another thing about our sense of smell. As we get older, many of us are less and less able to use our nose.
How old do you mean?
Well, about half of people over the age of 65 have some sort of trouble smelling things. And as you age even more, the sense weakens more. So for people over 80, we can expect some 3/4 to have problems with their ability to smell. And what's more, if you're a man, you can expect to have a weaker sense of smell than if you're a woman.
Roger, we were talking about perfume earlier. Now there's a huge industry based on people's sense of smell.
Yes, well, perfume is certainly big business. I read recently that in the United States alone, they sell $4.8 billion worth of perfume every year. And in Japan, the yearly sales are something like $5.5 billion, the world's biggest marketplace for the stuff.
I've always wondered what makes some people use certain perfumes.
I would say the number one reason is that they like the smell. But that's followed closely by reason number two, Marilyn. They think it's fashionable. Perfumes that people see as fashionable sell well. Just ask any of the big fashion companies. But the interesting thing about perfume is that one brand of perfume doesn't smell the same on every person who uses it.
Yes, I've noticed that before. Why is that?
Scientists don't know why for certain. Researchers in France think it has something to do with the liver. That is, the condition of your liver determines how the perfume will smell on you. But other scientists aren't too sure of that theory.
Isn't it also true that each person smells the same perfume differently?
It's hard to say because, for example, you and I might smell a perfume and, though we have the same sensation of the odour of the perfume, I may think it's a lovely smell and you may think it smells like last week's dinner.
I see what you mean. It's partly a matter of like and dislike then, isn't it, Roger?
That's right. In fact, there are people who dislike perfumes in general, any perfume. They feel it's an intrusion, you know, like cigarette smoke.
Wait, let me guess. You're going to tell me next that we're going to have anti-perfume campaigns, sort of like the campaigns against cigarette smoking indoors that have been so successful in so many places.
That's what I predict will happen, Marilyn. In fact, it's already begun in the United States, where I've heard...
That is the end of Section 3. You now have half a minute to check your answers. Listening Section 4. You are attending a talk for overseas students on greeting customs in Australia. The speaker is Mr. Jeff Barker, an anthropologist. Before you listen, look at questions 34 to 42. An example has been done for you. As you listen to the talk, answer questions 34 to 42.
Think about how you greet someone for the first time in your own country, in your own culture. When you are introduced to a stranger, do you shake hands with him or her? Perhaps it isn't the custom to touch each other. Instead, you may simply bow to each other or make no gesture at all. You know what to do in your own country. But what about when you go overseas for study or business? I've met many students who told me they were sometimes confused about these things in the first weeks after arriving here. And that's why I've been asked to give this talk to you today. Let's look at the act of shaking hands. And what I'm about to say applies mainly to men. When you're introduced to someone in a formal situation here in Australia, you always shake hands with them. And in an informal situation, it's quite common too. Shaking hands is the most accepted way of touching someone you don't know. And the idea of touching them is in itself important. If you don't shake someone's hand when they are clearly expecting it, the message you are sending is that you're not interested in them. So I advise you fellows to shake hands here even if you don't normally do so in your own country. If you think that simply shaking hands is enough, though, then you'd better listen to what I have to say next. How you shake hands is almost as important as the act itself. How you shake hands tells the other person a lot about you. It's true, and especially so of men. Here's what I mean. A limp or weak handshake by a man has the same meaning as no handshake at all. The message is, I'm not very interested in you. Think about this, because I know that some of you may come from cultures that accept limp handshakes as normal. Here, even if you don't intend to, you may send the wrong message. Is the best way, then, to use all your muscles and crush and possibly hurt the other person's hand? man-to-man handshakes in Australia are sometimes like this. The message behind this kind of handshake is aggressiveness and a desire to compete. Unless you specifically want to communicate these feelings to the other person, you don't have to shake hands with all your strength. One more type of male handshake that can send the wrong message is the half handshake. Here, only the front half of the fingers is offered to the other person's hand. The message is that you have little confidence, that you're shy. I'm not a strong or courageous person. That's what a half handshake says. Let's look now at how it is for women. Until recently, women in Australia felt no great need to shake hands during introductions. That's changed as more and more women are working in business, government, and academia. The way that women used to shake hands with men was to give only half the hand, that is, the fingers only. This gave little impression or message, at least to men. Nowadays, women are having to learn again how to shake hands. Now, women are beginning to offer all of the hand, the fingers and palm. The other person's hand is held and shaken firmly, but not too hard. This communicates to the other person more of a feeling of competence or strength than the old-fashioned way of doing it. How long should you shake hands? That's right, the length of time you shake hands also says something about you. If a man lets go of the other person's hand too quickly, what kind of message do you think that sends? Releasing your hand quite soon indicates that you don't want to get too involved, or you're not very interested in the other person. That goes for both women and men. However, it's both more acceptable and more common for two men to shake hands for a longer time, even as long as 6 or 7 seconds. The message in this case is, I like you, and generally indicates that the two men think they'll get on well. Finally, what do you do with your eyes when you're shaking a stranger's hand? In this society, at least, you should look at the other person straight in the eyes. If you look somewhere else, like looking down or to the side, this sends a negative message to the other person. The other person may think you're being arrogant, that your action says, I am better than you. Another unpleasant message that comes across when there is no eye contact is, you don't exist, or I don't recognize your existence. So you see, there really is quite a lot to consider when shaking hands in this culture. As silly as it may sound, practicing handshaking, say with a friend, may be a good way to become confident, so that the next time you need to introduce yourself in a formal setting here in Australia, you will feel comfortable knowing you did it the right way.
That is the end of section 4. You now have half a minute to check your answers. By Jacaranda Wiley Limited, 1996. This recording is copyright. Audio Cassette 2, Side B. Practice Listening Subtest, Paper 3. This is a practice listening test that resembles the IELTS listening test. It is a test to see how well you understand spoken English. You will hear several different recordings and you will have to answer questions on what you hear. The test is divided into 4 sections. There will be time for you to read the instructions and you will have a chance to check your work. You will hear each recording once only. At the end of the real IELTS listening subtest, you will have 10 minutes to transfer your answers to an answer sheet. Now turn to section 1 to begin the test. Listening Section 1. In a moment, you are going to hear a conversation between two university students, Vincent and Serena. They are meeting on their university campus. Before you listen, look at questions 1 to 5. As you listen to the first part of the conversation, answer questions 1 to 5.
Hi, Vincent. How are you?
Hello there, Serena. I'm well, thank you. I haven't seen you for ages. How have you been?
Good, thanks. I see you've just walked out of the Life Sciences building. You're not taking classes in biology or something, are you? I thought you were studying sociology.
I am studying sociology, Serena. I was just visiting a friend of mine who's doing research in biochemistry. Actually, I'm on my way to lunch, and then I've got a lecture.
Oh, well, look, I was just going to have a bite to eat as well. Shall we have something together?
That would be great.
The problem with this campus is that the town's so far away, which is where I prefer to eat. It seems like all the students are forced to eat here on campus.
Yeah, but there are quite a few places to choose from here. What if we go to the Student Union cafeteria? I go there sometimes. At least it's cheap.
Yes, the Union cafeteria is cheap, Vincent, but you get what you pay for. That's one place I try to avoid as much as possible. I only go there when I'm low on money or when they have live music. Besides, it's too crowded around lunchtime, and...
All right, I know. How about the Aztec Grill? Do you know that one? It's on the third floor of the Art Centre.
The Aztec Grill, huh? I think I've seen it, but I've never been there. Doesn't it specialise in Mexican food or something?
Yes, it's pretty spicy. Do you like spicy food?
Actually, I love spicy things, but I shouldn't be eating them at the moment. I just got over a stomach flu, so I prefer something mild.
I haven't got a problem with that. I guess I better let you pick a place then. Where would you like to go?
How about the Luxor Cafe?
The Luxor Cafe? You know, I've been on campus for over 2 years and I don't think I've ever heard of it. Where is it?
It's in the garden, behind the horticulture annex.
The horticulture annex? That's in the northwest part of campus, isn't it?
No, it's south of the observatory.
So it's near the football field then, behind Car Park C?
Not quite that far south. It's west of the Law Library.
Oh, right. I think I know where that is. It's not very far at all. Let's go.
Later, Vincent and Serena sit in the Luxor Cafe, deciding what to eat. Now look at questions 6 to 11. One example has been done for you. As the conversation continues, answer questions 6 to 11.
Well, the menu is quite extensive, isn't it? I feel I could spend hours deciding what to order.
Yes, I know what you mean. I think I'll have a salad to start with.
But there are so many salads to choose from.
Yeah, but I know what I like. I'll order the Greek salad.
If you know this place so well, I'd better follow your example. I'll have a Greek salad too.
Hey, wait a sec. If you order a different kind, we can share and have a greater variety.
All right. That sounds good to me. How about if I have a seafood salad then?
Good choice. They use fresh ingredients here, so you won't be disappointed. I'm quite hungry, so I'll have a sandwich too. A chicken sandwich.
I think I'll have some soup. Is the onion soup any good?
I don't know. I've never ordered it. It's not my favourite soup, to be honest. Why don't you try the tomato soup? I've had it here lots of times.
No, I think I'll stick with the onion. And I think I'll have a sandwich as well. You reckon the chicken's good, eh?
If you like chicken sandwiches, yes. The roast beef's quite tasty too.
No, I'll go with the chicken.
That's a lot of food you're ordering, Vincent. Are you sure you can get through all that?
Not a problem. I could eat a horse. Shall we order now? Oh, we still have to choose something to drink.
I'll have lemon tea. They say lemon tea is good for the stomach, which is what I need.
I'll have mineral water myself.
After eating, Vincent and Serena leave the cafe.
Well, it was nice having lunch with you, Vincent.
Yes. Have you got time to meet for lunch again next week, perhaps?
I don't see why not. Tuesdays and Fridays are bad for me, though. I've got tutorials and labs around lunchtime on those days. But I'm on campus every day, so...
I've got the same problem on Tuesdays, Thursdays and Fridays. I guess that leaves us with Monday or Wednesday.
Let's make it Monday. Why don't we meet here at the Luxor Cafe, say around 1:15?
You wouldn't want to make it a bit earlier, would you? Like 12:30 or 12:45? It would be better for me.
Well, I finish a lecture at 12:15, and I usually stick around to talk to the lecturer. But I guess 12:45 would be all right.
Good. Then it's settled. I'll see you then.
That is the end of section one. You now have half a minute to check your answers. Listening section 2. In a moment, you are going to hear a talk given by Mr. Alf Meersham, who works as a real estate agent in the city of Chapmanville. He is speaking to a group of newcomers about the city and rental accommodation to be found there. Before you listen, look at questions 12 to 22. Note the examples that have been done for you. As you listen to the talk, answer questions 12 to 22.
Hi, I'm Alf Meersham. I'm the rental manager for the Central Chapmanville Real Estate Agency. I'm a real estate agent much like any other, in that I help people buy and sell houses. But about half my time is spent working to assist people in renting houses and flats. I've been in this business for a dozen years now, and I know this city very well in terms of which areas are the better places to live and how much it costs to rent in these areas. Now, I normally divide Chapmanville into three areas in terms of rental prices. Generally speaking, the area in the north of the city is the low end of the spectrum, the cheapest housing. So, if you're looking to spend as little as possible on rent, I suggest you look there. The most expensive area would be the eastern part of Chapmanville. Most people think it's the prettiest part of the metropolitan area because of all the hills and parks. And because so many people desire to live there, housing prices tend to be quite high. The middle market, in terms of prices for accommodation, is found in the city's western and southern areas. Now, let me give you some examples of how much it will cost you to rent in these areas. Let's imagine you're a single person looking for a one-bedroom flat. In eastern Chapmanville, you would be paying no less than $650 a month for such a flat. You won't find anything for less than that. But a lot of people pay as much as $1,100 per month or more. The higher-priced flats are usually the ones in the hills, which run through the east. They've got the best views of the city. A similarly sized flat in the west of the city, and in the south too for that matter, would cost you at most about $650 a month. But there are many flats going for less, and if you look around a bit, you can find one for as little as $350. That's quite a reasonable rental price for most people. If you still find that too expensive, I suggest you head to Chapmanville's North, where the cheapest flats are to be found. One-bedroom flats there start from about $170 a month up to about $400. Now, for those of you who want something bigger, you'll have to be prepared to pay about double those prices for a small two- or three-bedroom house. That goes for any of the areas I mentioned. Okay, so much for prices. What are the advantages and disadvantages of these areas? Well, I told you that the eastern part of Chapmanville is the prettiest. There are lots of parks and lots of trees all around, and you've got the beautiful hills right there. In the south, you've also got the river, but you won't find too many parks there because of all the factories alongside the river. In fact, there's quite a bit of industry in the south, which makes it a less desirable place to live. Still, the south is convenient because of public transport. The south has very good train services to the city centre, as well as buses, and that's why a lot of people choose to live there. I said earlier that the western and southern parts of Chapmanville are about the same in terms of the price you pay for accommodation. They also have the same sort of public transport services, but the two areas are quite different in other ways. The west is next to the bay, so it's quite attractive in that sense. But there are a couple of problems with the west. One is that the bay is polluted. So polluted, in fact, that you wouldn't want to swim there. I used to take my family there about 10 years ago, but now I wouldn't go near it. The other disadvantage of the west is that that's where the airport is. The Chapmanville International Airport. The noise can be quite annoying. Lastly, the north. In northern Chapmanville, as I said before, housing is cheap. Quite cheap, in fact. But you pay in other ways. For example, the area is very low and is made up entirely of wetlands. It's beautiful in a way, but it attracts an incredible amount of insects for most of the year. The mosquitoes there are really bad. This makes things quite unpleasant, and so few people have any real wish to live there. But if money's a problem, that's the place to go. Just bring your insect repellent. Oh, I should mention that the only public transport in the north is buses. There aren't any trains, so it's not all that convenient, as you can imagine. Actually, eastern Chapmanville is in the same situation in terms of public transport, even though it's a richer part of the city. Don't ask me why that is, though. Let me just finish by again welcoming you all to Chapmanville and wishing you good luck in finding accommodation and settling down in whichever part of the city suits you best.
That is the end of section 2. You now have half a minute to check your answers. Listening section 3. In a moment, you are going to hear a conversation between three students, Wanda, Jack, and Annette. They are reviewing their lecture notes after hearing a lecture on the subject of bottle recycling. Before you listen, look at questions 23 to 32. Note the example that has been done for you. As you listen to the conversation, answer questions 23 to 32.
Hello, Wanda. Hello, Annette. I had trouble getting out of bed this morning, so I came to class a bit late. I got to the lecture theatre about 30 minutes after Professor Johnson began her lecture. Do you mind telling me what I missed?
Not at all, Jack. Actually, you didn't miss more than 15 minutes, because Professor Johnson arrived a bit late herself.
Which is pretty typical for her, isn't it?
It sure is. Let's see. How do your notes begin, Jack?
When I came in, she was talking about recycling of cans and the differences between can and bottle recycling.
Right, okay. Well, before that, she explained a little about glass bottle recycling. She said that glass recycling is still far more efficient than recycling other materials. That's because there's no loss of quality, no matter how many times the glass is recycled.
That's interesting.
She also talked about the tiny little pieces of glass you get when you break up bottles in the recycling process. What's that called again, Annette?
It's called cullet. It's spelt C-U-L-L-E-T.
Yes, that's right. The professor said that there are bottle factories in some parts of the world, like Japan and the US, that make their bottles entirely from cullet.
So they don't use new glass?
That's right.
What about bottle factories elsewhere?
Let me just check my notes. The bottles made in most places contain about 3/4 new glass, and the rest is recycled.
I guess recycling is better for the environment than just throwing things away and using new materials all the time. But wouldn't it be even better to reuse the same bottles without breaking them up into colours?
Yeah, Professor Johnson talked about that too. She said if you reuse bottles, you save on energy and resource costs. She said that in parts of Britain, beer bottles are still reused rather than recycled. But, she said, that reusable bottles have to be built stronger than the kinds of bottles that are recycled after they're used only once.
But then they last forever, don't they?
Actually, no. Reusable bottles can be cleaned and refilled a maximum of 30 times, and then they become too weak to use again. They're crushed and recycled.
But it still sounds better than just recycling. My parents tell me that when they were children, a lot more things came in reusable bottles and jars. It really seems like we've moved away from reusing, doesn't it? Did Professor Johnson talk about why that's so?
Well, she discussed why it's so difficult to maintain a system of returning and reusing bottles.
What reasons did she mention?
Well, a few things. One factor is that there's an increasing variety of bottle types on the market. You know, when you walk into a supermarket, you see virtually hundreds of different types of drinks, and each one has its own bottle shape and colour. In other words, there is virtually no standardisation. And standardisation is necessary to keep a bottle reusing system going. It gets too complicated and expensive to have a separate scheme for each bottle type.
That makes sense. So we're paying for the variety of bottles by having to recycle them rather than reuse them.
I guess that's right. But that's not the only problem. Apparently, shopkeepers are another obstacle. They don't want to have to collect all the returned bottles. Shopkeepers claim they can't afford the time it takes and that it's not their responsibility anyway.
I suppose I can see their point, in a way, but in terms of the environment, it's not a very caring attitude, is it?
No, but things may be changing. Professor Johnson said that governments are beginning to realise the need to cut down on waste. So some places are making laws that require everyone to return their bottles for reuse. It's happening in Denmark and in parts of Canada. In those countries, a person who buys something in a bottle, like a soft drink, is responsible for returning the bottle once they've finished with it. If they don't, they're breaking the law. Also, bottle makers aren't allowed to make bottles that cannot be reused.
That's encouraging. Anything else?
Well, she then talked about plastic bottles. She said that it's still better environmentally to buy things packaged in glass bottles because recycling them is more efficient. But there are relatively recent programs for recycling plastics, and recycling plastics has its advantages.
Such as?
She said that recycling of plastics uses one-tenth the energy of creating new plastic.
Only a tenth of the energy, did you say? Wow. So recycling plastics has its benefits too.
Finally, she said that we should also look at other factors about bottled use too, like transportation. Obviously, there's an environmental cost in transporting bottles to and from factories and shops. She said plastics are better than glass in this respect because they're lighter. For glass, one ton is about 2,000 average bottles. For plastic, it's 10 times that. That's 20,000 bottles per ton.
That's quite a difference, isn't it? Maybe plastic is the way to go, after all.
That is the end of section 3. You now have half a minute to check your answers.